Welcome to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues, your weekly guide through matters crucial to families and the preservation of traditional values in the Commonwealth and beyond. Archives of this and past shows are available at afaofpa.org. Now your host, a dedicated advocate for family values and the director of the American Family Association of Pennsylvania, Diane Gramley.
The United States of America, it officially began 250 years ago. After decades of trying to reason with a tyrannical King George III, the Founding Fathers finally came to the conclusion that there was no reasoning with him. They gathered in Philadelphia, vigorously debated whether to declare our independence and face the wrath of the world's superpower. They voted for independence, signed the Declaration of Independence, which listed their grievances against the British crown, and the rest is history. With God's miraculous intervention, we became a free nation. That was Philadelphia in 1776. What is today's Philadelphia like? Would such a gathering of freedom seekers even be allowed to meet within the city? My guest today is Karis Coker, who lives in the Philadelphia suburbs. Thanks, Karis, for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Diane. It's always a joy to be with you.
So there's still a lot of buildings in that area, in the Philadelphia area, that existed when the Declaration of Independence was signed. That includes Carpenter's Hall and, of course, Independence Hall. And, in fact, you live in a colonial period home yourself. So beyond that, describe what Philadelphia is today?
Well, the buildings are still there, and I'm very thankful for that, for how many still remain. In addition to the ones you mentioned, I think of Bishop White's house, William White, who was the patriarch of the Anglican Church, which then became the Episcopal Church, the shepherd of the flock. His home is still standing, and many others along that route. But while the buildings are still there, what goes on the streets and inside the buildings and throughout the city has changed drastically, as I'm sure you are aware.
Yeah. So they're not singing hymns and such as Benjamin Franklin described after George Whitefield preached? They're not doing that in Philadelphia anymore?
You're right. He did say that, didn't
he? Yeah, he did.
That you could walk down the street and you could hear hymns and Bible reading and prayer from every house. No, it's a far cry. It's still in as great a need of the gospel, of the principles of our founding, but worlds apart at the present time.
Definitely not the same Philadelphia. I mean, I've been to too many Philadelphia gay pride parades and festivals to see that things taking place in that city that would never have been even thought of by our founding fathers. So you mentioned it became the Episcopal Church. So a Christ Church is still there, correct?
Yes, it is. And there are some of the notable persons buried there on that property who we can see beneath the surface that are probably in a continual rollover in their graves.
That's for sure. Absolutely,
so,
for sure.
In fact, at Christ Church, it previously, like 10 years ago and before, visitors could come and walk in and through the church and give thought, some thoughtful moments to the things that transpired there and the persons who were part of our founding government and then the unfolding, even under the constitutional government when it was in Philadelphia in 1790 to 1800. But they have begun to charge. Now you can't go into that sanctuary without a gift.
Oh, really? Because, my family and I went in one time, saw where George Washington's pew was, and it was locked, that little area.
And many others. Little areas.
So now you have to pay to go in and see empty pews in the sanctuary?
You have to pay.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, you do. Yes, to go in.
Do they still hold services there?
Yes, they do. The services are of a very different content and a very different emphasis and direction than they were once upon a time.
So they're not preaching the same time.
The building is still there.
The building is still there, but the content and the contents are still there. But what is being preached from the pulpit is not the same as in 1776, I'm assuming.
Not at all. It's interesting, the pulpit in the Christ Church is a reflection. In most Anglican Episcopal churches of the time, the communion table was the point of focus. The fact that there's even an elevated pulpit at Christ Church is a reflection of the impact of the gospel and the preaching and even the Great Awakening later on when that building was being designed. They were organized around 1700, but the building that's currently there was designed afterwards, before the
Declaration. Okay, wow. So much history. And, you know, all this stuff's going on. And city council, would they go to, do you think they would have allowed the 1776 freedom seekers to have met in Independence Hall or anyplace else in the city?
Well, they certainly are not friendly to persons who hold those views who appear before the current city council. That's for sure. In fact, they have even resorted at times to having them removed from the meeting of the city council.
Wow.
And so, no, I'm inclined to think that they would not be too friendly. It reminds me of, you know, John Wesley went back to preach at his father's church, and they put him out, and so he preached on his father's tombstone.
Oh, wow.
And so I think if Wesley came back today to preach in a United Methodist church, they would probably put him out
to preach in the graveyard. There's no question that they would put John or Charles Wesley out, for sure.
Even so, the Philadelphia and Pennsylvania state government, I think they would be a bit undone and trying to figure out how to stop the rhetoric, the remark from someone who would be in agreement with the founding fathers.
And there's so much history in Philadelphia that points to God. There's so much history in the state capitol building that points to God. And it's all being ignored. That's the sad part. And kids in school are not being taught the true history of the founding of this nation. And again, that's very, very sad. I know that, I think it was in like 1782 on Market Street there in Philadelphia, I guess there was a little coffee house, and Robert Atkin issued the first English Bible printed in America from that location.
Yeah.
And actually it included, there was a congressional resolution was passed recommending that Bible to all the inhabitants of the U.S. to read the Bible. So,
well, you know,
I was just going to say, would Congress do that again?
Would Congress do that again?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Now, I think the latest recognition of the scriptures we had was the year of the Bible. Was that under Reagan? Which is not so long ago.
That's not that.
But, you know, under the crown, it was against the law for anyone else to print the Bible besides Cambridge and Oxford. And they were the only printers authorized by the crown. Anyone else could be punished for it. It was considered illegal. So that's why after war broke out with Britain, there were no Bibles available. Congress saw the essential need for the scriptures to be available to the citizens, and so they had Atkins print it for distribution to meet the gap since Britain wasn't shipping Bibles here anymore.
Right, and it's interesting because England has a very dark history when it comes to making the scriptures available to people. They killed John Wycliffe for translating the Bible into English. Then with King James, I'm sure that came down from King James as far as only select places could publish the Bible. And it came down from him in 1611 on down through the 1700s with King George,
In spite of all of that, even with the resistance that they met, it was through England that the Bible was translated into the language of the common people because of persons like Wycliffe and Tyndale, who laid their lives on the line. They pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to getting the word of God into the hands of the people, which reminds me that expression of the people, by the people, and for the people, that came from either Wycliffe or Tyndale. I forget which one.
Oh, wow.
Yes. They saw that the scriptures needed to be in the hands of the people in order to give them solid ideas about the role of government as God intended it to be, as opposed to how the kings wanted it.
How the king interpreted it, or how a leader or the leaders interpreted it. That's so essential for anything. If you have the original documents of anything, then you can know what it really says and what the intent of the writers of those documents were. Now, 10 years later, you mentioned that in 1792, there's a Brown's Bible published in New York. What's history behind that?
Brown's Bible published in the state of New York. It's the first Bible published there, and it was commissioned while Congress was under the Constitution, which went into effect on March 4th, 1789. And Brown's Bible had been printed earlier in Europe, in Scotland and Ireland, and in it, people in America wanted to reprint it. And they solicited support, subscriptions as they were called then, financial support to help bring it into print. And it was printed in 40 different sections. And as they came off the press, then they were sent to the persons who had purchased it. And then they would take it to a bookbinder and have it put together. So you have a lot of different covers on the different individual editions. But the value of that book is that on that list of subscribers, which is several pages long, there George Washington, Esquire, President of the United States, is the first one listed.
Wow.
And then in that list of persons who helped to support and bring it into print, you have every member of Washington's cabinet except Jefferson and multiple other persons who are in the House or the Senate or like judge of the territory south of the River Ohio, many other persons who were in government. And then, though, the crowning glory, well, I guess it competes with Washington's signature.
Yeah.
But there's a frontispiece, which is an engraving, which there's a lot of things illustrated and represented in that engraving, including the Liberty Tree and so forth. But there's a woman seated with the Constitution, a scroll unrolled on her lap. There's a woman kneeling beside her with the Holy Scriptures open, and there are rays of light from the Bible illuminating the Constitution.
Wow.
And this is what our founding fathers envisioned as what influenced what. And you know that the book of Deuteronomy was the single book most often quoted at the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah, I'd read that.
And the Bible itself was quoted much more than any other book.
I wonder how much the Bible's quoted in Congress today.
Oh, you keep asking these questions about now and then and now. You know, that's one reason that I have never, when I give tours in Philadelphia, I do not wear a period outfit of the time, because I don't want people to relegate all of those things to back there.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to understand that these things were then, they have ongoing merit and interest and value, not
Absolutely.
Just for a time to the past.
Yeah. Yeah, the founding fathers did not just plan on, you know, the Declaration of Independence and the subsequent Constitution to be just for their time period. They expect the Constitution to control, to describe how the nation was supposed to work. And we veered from that.
It was a republic, which is a form of a democracy, but a republic with a written constitution, and which meant that that constitution was a boundary beyond which the will of the people cannot even go, even if it's expressed through their representatives or by a referendum. Because even if the will of the people should vote against one of the those Bill of Rights, it cannot be done. Now, it provided for amendments, but there are certain rights till those amendments were made. I'm talking about changes beyond it.
Beyond the first 10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That constitution is a corral for legislation. And if it goes beyond that, it's frankly illegitimate.
Yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, we see an awful lot of that. And I think a lot of that is because people have not read the Constitution. There's not enough interest in what the Constitution says. They don't realize that there's limited government.
But they've taken an oath to uphold it.
They have. I know. And I know a lot of times when we send voter guides out, like our first question is, have you voter guide questions to candidates? First question, have you read the U.S. Constitution? Have you read, and if they're running for Pennsylvania, legislature, have you read the Pennsylvania Constitution? Oh, yes, yes, yes. Always yes. Like, prove it. But, have to take their word for it. But their actions tell you whether they really have read and understand those documents.
I was speaking with a candidate on the state level who was running for office in the primary, and he was a Democrat, and I said to him, if you will promise me that you will uphold the Constitution, I'll vote for you. And he said, what do you mean? He had not read the Constitution.
Oh, my goodness.
Said, don't you know that if you are elected, you have to take an oath to uphold, support, defend, and uphold the Constitution? He was thoroughly surprised and astonished. He said, I do?
No kidding.
He
had
no idea.
Oh, my goodness.
No. And this was 15, 20 years ago. So.
Unfortunately, I think those are just, they take an oath, yes, but I think in too many cases, those are just empty words that they're saying as they take that oath. They don't take it to heart.
Absolutely.
Because their voting record, you can tell from their voting record.
It screams their disregard of the Constitution.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, looking back at talking about churches, you had said that the Presbyterian or Anglican Church, then that became Presbyterians. Is that how that worked?
No, the Anglican Church then.
Oh, it was the Episcopal.
Loyalty to the crown was broken. They became the Episcopal Church.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. But did the Presbyterian Church play any role in the during that time frame during the 1770s? Were they?
Boy, that's a loaded question.
Okay. Okay. I'm throwing one of those.
I'm sure you're acquainted, but some of your audience may not be, with William Tennant and the Log College, which was founded in just north of Philadelphia. And there's a wonderful historical marker there now, which was dedicated in 1920s with the United States presidents, senators, representatives, governors, all kinds of people there who honor the work of this man. And his preacher boys out of the Log College became the Great Awakening. They were all, his own sons and were involved with Jonathan Edwards and George Whitfield in the Great Awakening. That has been called the grand rehearsal for the American Revolution. And it was so recognized their influence in defense of religious liberty that they said over in London that America had run off with her Presbyterian cousin. That's what happened.
Yeah.
So, yes, the Presbyterians, and of course, you know, John Witherspoon, his middle name, by the way, was Knox, John Knox.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He was a descendant of John Knox. And as was Patrick Henry.
Okay.
Dr. John Witherspoon, who probably would have been at the Constitutional Convention, except the Presbyterians were having a major conference at the very same time as the Constitutional Convention, and he presided.
And he was the president. He was the president of the College of New Jersey, which became Princeton, correct? Witherspoon?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
And now the College of New Jersey was birthed out of the Log College when William Tennant died in 47. His graduates and students got together and formed the College of New Jersey, and then it was located over in New Jersey. And even on the gate, which Princeton really tries to distance itself and, you know, disassociate itself now from the Log College and the fervent gospel message that came out of there.
Well, like Yale and Harvard and all the other ones. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But it has on its gate in bronze from way back, has 1727, and that's the year that William Tennant founded his Log College.
Wow.
Yeah, it wasn't until 1747 that after he died, it became then the College of New Jersey.
That's fantastic. Now,
if I could point out with the Declaration of Independence 250th anniversary coming up on Saturday, you had two men from the College of New Jersey who went to England to persuade John Witherspoon to return or to come to America to be the president there. And that was Richard Stockton and Benjamin Rush. And both of those men, along with Witherspoon, are signers to the Declaration. So yes, the Presbyterians had quite a significant role.
So they're all going to celebrate the 250th birthday of the U.S.
Not officially, which is a real tragedy.
Yeah,
a real tragedy.
They're ignoring their own history.
Yes.
Now Pennsylvania had several signers of the Declaration of Independence, of which one was John Morton. Give us a little bit of a history about John Morton.
John Morton grew up in what is now Chester County. He grew up in Delaware as part of the settlement. Anyway, Delaware County was then part of Chester County. So he served as a sheriff, a local judge, and his career of service, public service, and as a Christian man resulted in him being the Speaker of the Pennsylvania Assembly. And then right before the Declaration of Independence, for two or three years, and maybe a little longer before that, there was like the old guard, which was associated with the Penn family, and there was the new guard, which was associated with those Presbyterians and the frontiersmen in Pennsylvania, and there was really an internal civil war going on inside Pennsylvania. And all of John Morton's associations and past doings would cause him to line with being opposed to the Declaration of Independence. But he weighed all things, and Pennsylvania's vote hung in the balance. There were five delegates, two for, two against, and what he was going to do would determine the outcome of the Pennsylvania vote, whether to support the Declaration of Independence or not. And he voted to support it, and he suffered much. All of his extended family, his church associates, his business associates, the people involved in civil government that felt that he had betrayed them, and they maligned him and charged him seriously. He became very sick, and he was the first one of the signers to die. He died early in 1777.
Oh, wow.
But it said that his remarks near the end of his life were that all those who had opposed him would come to see in time that his vote to support that Declaration of Independence, the most honorable service he had ever done for his country.
So even back then, I don't think we realize how close the vote was for independence.
Well, then you have Delaware.
Yeah, with Cesar Rani. Yeah, yeah. Give us a little bit of history on Cesar Rani. Actually, I just learned some of this stuff, and I'm still upset that I didn't know it when I lived back there. So who was Cesar Rani?
There were three delegates to the Continental Congress from Delaware. One was for, one was against. Cesar Rodney was out of town. He was very sick. He had a cancer growth on his face that he wore a kerchief over half of his face to hide the disfigurement. His health was not good. He was back home in Dover, Delaware. He was also tending to matters of there at a state level and local level politically. And he got word that the vote was being taken for the Declaration of Independence and that Delaware was tied between the other two delegates. He got on a horse and rode 80 miles nonstop, except to swap horses, through a thunderstorm, and he arrived in the providence of God just in time to make a difference in the Delaware vote, and he went straight to Independence Hall, cast his vote for independence. Thus, Delaware joined the independence movement. And it's interesting, Delaware had already, I don't see how this works. Delaware had already declared its independence as a state from England and from Pennsylvania on June 15th. But there was still the rumblings within an opposition. On a state level, the supporters of independence overcame the opposition.
And really, state could not take on England as just a single state. But when it came to all 13 colonies uniting,
it was important. So, but on their delegation that had been elected to the Continental Congress, there was one of the delegates that was still not willing to sign his name. Well, you know, it may be that he was not so much opposed to it, but if you signed that document, you were signing your death warrant if Britain won the war.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because they were guilty of treason, according to Britain.
Yeah, and some did lose their lives as far as some, you know, some were injured in battle. Many lost their, because they pledged their lives, their fortune, and their sacred honor. Many lost their fortunes. They lost sons, they lost properties, they lost their lives in some cases. So, you know, we just take our liberties for granted, and that's not fair to what our founding fathers sacrificed for us. We need to take seriously our liberties and protect our liberties. You know, it's just our responsibility to carry on their vision for this nation. Now, you lead tours. Give us a little bit of information about tours that you give.
I do have my certification as a historic tour guide in Philadelphia, but on my website, AmericanLibertyTours.com, it can be a tour to Annapolis to explore the things there, or to Old Newcastle, or to Valley Forge, or any of the historic Pensbury Manor, or historic Philadelphia. And there's a great variety of options. There's so much more than one day would cover, certainly, in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
So take your pick.
Because you have to deal with, one thing, you have to deal with traffic now. You didn't have to deal with traffic so much back in 1776.
Yeah, but you had to walk everywhere,
too. That's true, too. That's true, too. Because even now, even though Philadelphia has some of those narrow, brick-covered streets, and I just,
I love some of those streets.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're so full of history. So, Karis, thanks so much. So that's AmericanLibertyTours.com is your website.
Yeah.
And I do encourage our listeners, 250 years.
We have a great legacy.
We do.
We have a great legacy.
We absolutely do.
Is there human flaw and error in it? What human undertaking does not show?
Exactly.
Have some flaw.
Yeah.
But we have the best thing going.
And we better not blow it.
No.
So, anyway.
May God help us.
Absolutely. So AmericanLibertyTours.com. I'm going to encourage our listeners to go check out Karis's website. She's full of lots and lots more information than what we could cover in this program. So thanks so much, Karis.
Have a wonderful 250th.
I plan on it. Take care.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us on American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues. Please note that the views and opinions expressed by our guest are their own and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the AFA of Pennsylvania. We value your opinions as well. To continue the conversation, visit afaofpa.org, where you'll find links to all our social media. If you're passionate about defending traditional values in our state, we invite you to get involved with the American Family Association of Pennsylvania. Visit our website at afaofpa.org or write P.O. Box 1048, Franklin, Pennsylvania 16323. to learn more, and to take action. Together, we can make a difference for the families and the future of Pennsylvania.